Rated R. It contains violence, adult language, nudity, and adult content.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 o'clock, Wednesday, December 25th, 2019. It's Christmas Day Eve. And thanks for joining us for the 82nd episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Yeah, I don't think anybody doesn't know what that was, but for those folks who are unfamiliar with traditional Judeo-Christian, particularly Christian, Christmas music, that was Jingle Bells, which was originally, has an interesting history, because it was originally written for Thanksgiving and had nothing to do with Christmas. Originally written with the title One Horse Open Sleigh by a guy named James Pierpont, who wrote it in 1857. And it was originally, you know, it's kind of one of these things he wrote for a Thanksgiving celebration. Well, it got picked up by a blackface performer on stage called Johnny Pell, who performed it on September of the same year, 1857, and everybody thought it was really catchy, and some of the choirs adopted it and went, this is great, and became a very popular parlor song to play and all kinds of stuff during the 1880s, and then eventually was recorded in 1889 on one of those old, what do they call them, Edison cylinders.
Oh.
And it is reportedly, yeah, it's reportedly the very first Christmas recording. But anyway, it was originally written for Thanksgiving, but everybody, it got so popular when it got put in front of the stage that people adopted for Christmas, and ever since then it's been known as a Christmas tune, and the title changed from One Horse Open Sleigh to Jingle Bells. So that's the history of the song we all know as Jingle Bells that we thought was written for Christmas. Well, was it?
Oh, wow. Well, that's kind of neat. Thank you.
Isn't that cool?
For that little story. Yes, it is. That is a fun arrangement, too. I love the effects on that one.
Yeah, I did that I did that running the guitar through a synth with the tubular bells.
Oh, wow.
I was like, why not, right? It's Christmas. Come on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled Bite the Hand That Feeds, the National Suicide Hotline, which we will discuss in a moment, not to make things somber. But we're going to have a little real talk tonight. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, which is a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Yeah, I thought we could use a little levity and lightheartedness before we got into the heavy-dutiness of the talk. I also have a very interesting piece of musical history this evening, other than the one I just talked about. So I want to talk about a little-known instrument that people have heard, although they probably don't know they've heard it, and they probably don't know the name of the instrument, and if they'd heard the name, they went, oh, I've heard of that. I have no idea what it is, even though it's in the title of a couple of songs. So the instrument I'm speaking about tonight is the hurdy-gurdy. So for folks who don't know what that is, it is a stringed instrument that looks like a violin on a box, basically, with a hand crank. And so what happens is you have a wheel instead of a bow that's been rosined that rubs up against the strings and produces this violin bow kind of sound, except that how you play it is with these little keyboard-looking things attached to the hurdy-gurdy. So while you're cranking it with one hand, you're hitting the keys with the other hand and making the wheel hit the strings in a certain position.
Whoa.
Yeah,
it
most
like
of them have
drone.
Yeah, and it has, like the bagpipe, it has a drone, because it has drone strings like a sitar. So you have this kind of while somebody's doing the little fingering technique on the little keyboard dillies. So this thing has been in existence since medieval times. It was really popular back in the day, and it's originated in Europe, and you know is still used in a lot of the folk music there and in a lot of the popular genres there. Currently, and originally the strings like on a violin were made of gut, but some of them are now made of metal. But they're mostly still made of gut, and they're mounted typically these days with either violin strings, usually in the key of D or A, or cello strings in the key of A, G, and C. But occasionally, metal strings have been used. There also is a version of it that is now electronic. So they have this they have an electric version, which has a pickup in it, like electric guitar, and then they have sort of like an acoustic electric, and then they have a totally electronic version, which hooks up like a MIDI synthesizer and can be hooked up and played electronically, and you can add all sorts of effects on them. So there's a player, Anna Murphy, in Europe, who is really well known for this, and she used to play with a kind of a modern rockish, Celtic-ish kind of band that she would use this on. She's gone on her own. Folks in this country would more than likely know, however, some of the following musicians that I'm going to talk about who have used the hurdy-gurdy in songs, and they're like, oh, I had no clue. So Ritchie Blackmore of Deep Purple, and then after Deep Purple, Rainbow, and then after Rainbow, Black Moore's Night, which is sort of this Celtic-y, Renaissance-y type band that he fronts with his partner, Candace Knight, ergo the name of the band, Black Moore's Night. And she plays hurdy-gurdy on a lot of their songs. Nigel Eaton, who most people don't know, who's a studio person in England, did the hurdy-gurdy on the Page and Plant Unleaded album, and he does it on the cut Nobody's Fault But Mine. Also, Jimmy Page himself plays the hurdy-gurdy in the movie The Song Remains the Same. So, and also using a hurdy-gurdy in the Gallows Pole, a song Gallows Pole. On the movie, Page is playing it in a song called Autumn Lake, and he's actually playing the hurdy-gurdy himself. Jim Finer plays a hurdy-gurdy on one of the Pogues songs, Misty Morning, Albert Bridge, from their album Peace and Love, and he's playing that on that. And then Sting, believe it or not, plays a hurdy-gurdy on one of Alison Krauss's songs from the Cold Mountain soundtrack. I think the song that he plays it on is You Will Be My Ain True Love. The U.S., yeah, in the U.S., we know it because Bruce Springsteen's album The Rising has a track called Into the Fire, and Brendan O'Brien is playing the hurdy-gurdy on that. On one of Lou Reed's records, I think it's The Raven, there's a guy named Frank Wolf that is playing a hurdy-gurdy on two of the songs off that album, because that album is very Poe-referenced. So Overture, he's playing a hurdy-gurdy on, and The Fall of the House of Usher, he's playing a hurdy-gurdy on. On one of Weezer's tunes, from their album Hurley, I think the track's called Hang On, but don't quote me on that. Tony Berg is playing a hurdy-gurdy. And finally, David Miles plays the hurdy-gurdy on Low Man's Lyric, which is off the famous Metallica album Reload. So people have heard it. They just don't know they heard it.
I have one addendum to that, actually. We do have a caller this evening who we'll talk to later in the show. And her name is Crystal, and she mentions in the chat room that the hurdy-gurdy is also used for the opening of the TV show Black Sails, which is a prequel to the book Treasure Island. So she thought you guys might get a kick out of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right. Oh, thanks for that. That's great. Yeah, that's right. It sure is. Yeah. So I just love stuff like that.
Awesome. Okay, so does that conclude our trivia? I don't want to jump ahead of the game here.
No, we're done. I just wanted to – I thought being Christmas, and to me Christmas always – this time of year in general, the fall, with whether it's Christmas or Yule or whatever, always reminds me of castles and mystical stuff and, you know, medieval things and Renaissance stuff. And I don't know where – recently I heard a hurdy-gurdy on something. I can't remember what the heck it was on, and I went – I need to do something on that. And being the time, I thought, oh, this would be great for the Christmas show. So why I'm doing it.
In fact, earlier tonight before we did this, I was watching a PBS show that was about the Tudor Christmas traditions. And they had the people all up in costume and the foods and the instruments and the dances. Right. And it was quite fascinating. Very lovely stuff. Crystal has also mentioned in the chat room that they sell hurdy-gurdy kits that you can make your own out of wooden string, so you can have one of your own at home. So everybody can have one now.
You're...
Hurdy-gurdy's for everybody.
Yeah, unless you're a moron like me that has like a zero mechanical reasoning skills, and then you buy a kit and get somebody else to do it.
Well, that's fair. That's totally fair. No problem.
You're a lazy rock and roll shrink.
Oh, gosh. Oh, she says that's what boyfriends are for.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, not exactly that is the case, but you never know. If you can get somebody to do it, that's more power to you. All righty. So thank you for that. I appreciate the fun little trivia stories, and Again, we will be taking calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. Feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Okay, and I'm going to throw my little wave that I did for you guys last time in one more time, just because by the time I see you next time, it'll be 2020, and I'll have to wait until I can play this next year. So here we go. Last little bit of upbeatness from Lita Ford. Tonight's show is called Bite the Hand That Feeds, the National Suicide Hotline. So while it might not be a cheery holiday topic, the fact remains that major holidays such as the Hanukkah, Yule, Christmas, and New Year's season tend to also exacerbate depression and loneliness for many people. And it is also a season where some can become despondent, grieve heavily, and even consider suicide. Suicide was our very first topic on this show, and one of the top three that we continue to address from various angles. In recent news, it was announced that a new simplified national suicide crisis hotline number is being established by the FCC, which opened up a lot of dialogue about the efficacy of the hotline model and how also why it sometimes may not serve as many of its intended clients as possible. So tonight, we will discuss first the new National Suicide Hotline, information on that, Suicide Hotline Overview second, and that's basically how the model works, kind of show you guys how that functions. Third is trust issues with Suicide Hotline. Sometimes the model does not work for everybody. We'll talk about that a little bit, and we have a guest caller who can speak about their experiences with that. And then last, we will talk about resources and suggestions for coping, and that's from different angles, from the people who are suicidal or despondent, and also their family, friends, coworkers, all that, different angles on coping with that. Before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to add before we dive in.
Nope, I'm good. Thank you.
All righty, so let's go. First, I wanted to remind our listeners about some prior episodes of our radio show that talk about topics related to tonight's discussion. Here are previous episodes on suicide and depression from a variety of angles. You can find them on iTunes or on blogtalkradio.com in the archives by searching for them by titles or keywords. So we have several here. As I've mentioned earlier, this is one of our most covered topics. The very first one, episode one, Musicians and Suicide, that was from July of 2016. Episode nine, Holiday Depression, part one of three, that was from November of 2016. Episode 10, Maintaining Sobriety and Health During the Holidays, part two of three, that was December 2016. These are companion shows. Episode 11, also a companion show, Reasonable and Rational New Year's Resolutions, Part 3 of 3, December 2016. Episode 21, Suicide and Depression Follow-Up, Part 1, that was from May of 2017. That was a general overview of the topic. And Episode 22, Suicide and Depression Follow-Up, Part 2, also in May, end of May, 2017. That was Suicide in the News and Media. And then last, but certainly not least, episode 45, And to Those They Left Behind, from May of 2018, which is about veterans, PTSD, and depression or suicide, where they talk about, 22 suicides a day amongst veterans. And Dr. Mathis and I had a guest on who let us know that the real number, when you take into account some of the reckless behavior on purpose, is actually closer to 60. So feel free to look these episodes up later and give them a listen when you get a chance. Coping with depression and suicidal ideation is one of our top topics on this show, as you can see from the large number of prior episodes addressing various aspects of it. All right. So So let's get started. The first thing I want to talk about is the news, the new National Suicide Hotline. So a couple weeks ago, news sources announced that a simplified National Suicide Hotline modeled after the 911 and 411 formats was proposed by the FCC and in the process of being approved and created. So in other words, it's not active yet. The FCC recommended that 988 be designated as a national crisis hotline. You can write it down if you want, but understand this isn't final. So if you know, put it in your address book or whatever, they may not go with that as the final number, but that's up to you. So please continue to use their current number, which is 800-273-TALK-8255, and they have a chat page, Suicide Prevention Lifeline, all one word, .org/chat, with anybody who wishes to connect to the lifeline in the meantime. Remember, 988 is not currently active and will not yet connect callers to the lifeline. Next thing I want to read for you guys is an article about this, and it gives more detail about the situation. And this is called Three-Digit Suicide Hotline Number on Its Way by Trudy Ring. It was written December 12th in theadvocate.com. And Trudy says, the Federal Communications Commission Thursday, and that meant December 12th, approved plans to go ahead with a three-digit number for a suicide prevention hotline. The five members of the commission approved the plan unanimously, CNN reports. Now there will be a period of public comment, and the commission will start the rulemaking process. Quote, the number will be 988. 988 has an echo of the 911 number we all know as an emergency number, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai said at the commission's meeting. And we believe that this three-digit number dedicated for this purpose will help ease access to crisis services. It will reduce the stigma surrounding suicide and mental health conditions, and ultimately it will save lives, end quote. In proposing the three-digit hotline back in August, Pai had mentioned the epidemic of suicide among certain vulnerable populations, including LGBTQ youth. The source this is from, The Advocate, caters to that. His comment came upon the issuance of a report from the SEC's Wireline Competition Bureau and Office of Economics and Analytics. The report pointed out that a three-digit number would be easier to access than longer ones, and it also recommended specialized services for LGBTQ youth, veterans, and other at-risk groups. And by this, they mean groups that have a tendency to be in situations that exacerbate suicidal thoughts much more often than the general populace. The proposal approved Thursday includes those services. The Trevor Project, which works to prevent suicide among LGBTQ young people, praised the commission's move. The proposal set up an 18-month timeline for phone companies to implement the 988 number, and this does take time to set up in the infrastructure. But it also asks for public input on whether it will take more time to do so or if it can be done earlier, CNN notes. The measure does not include the option of text messaging, however. Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel said that is an error, as, quote, texting is primary for so many young people, and, pardon, it would be a mistake for us to build a system that presumes talk is the only starting point for discussion, end quote. The Trevor Project and some other services offer a texting option. And I'm going to pause here and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you'd like to add before we continue.
Nope, I'm good, thanks.
Okay, so the next section is Suicide Hotlines Overview. So next, we'd like to give you guys an overview of how the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline currently works, as well as a couple of appendix crisis lines for specialized demographics so our listeners know what to expect. Most people haven't ever called such a line. Most people and never have this experience. So almost everybody that's calling it is a first-timer. You don't get a lot of repeat callers. So the article I want to read to you is What Actually Happens When You Call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. This article is by Aliyah E. Dastagir, D-A-S-T-A-G-I-R, and she's a writer for USA Today. And I actually quote three of her articles tonight. She appears to be specializing in this topic. This particular one was written in September of 2018. And she says, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline launched on January 1st, 2005. And in its first year of operation, answered a little over 46,000 calls. In 2017, it answered over 2 million. The Lifeline has significantly increased in call volume, but it says there are still people in crisis it doesn't reach. Some people having suicidal thoughts are afraid to call, worrying doing so may compromise their privacy or their autonomy. USA Today spoke with the Lifeline's director, John Draper, and communications director, Francis Gonzalez, about what happens when a person calls 800-273-TALK. Some questions and answers below are from the article, and some of them are directly from the NSPL website. Primarily, the first few are from the article, and then later ones are from the website that they cited in the article. So, question, who calls the Lifeline? Gonzalez says, 25 to 30% of callers have a suicide-related issue, which was a strikingly low number, in my opinion. I was surprised by that. Others call because they are in emotional distress or looking for resources and information. Question, what kind of personal information will I be expected to give? Gonzalez says, calls are confidential. People can be anonymous if they choose. They can share as much or as little personal information during the call as they like. Question, who will pick up? Draper says, people who are trained to deal with this conversation. They don't panic. They're ready to listen and to assess the nature and severity of the problem and help de-escalate. Question, if I call the Lifeline, is it possible someone will be sent to my home? Draper says, it's rare that we ever have to do anything that a person doesn't want us to do. Of those people at highest risk, about 75% of the time we are actively able to collaborate with them and help them reduce their own risk. We would only do active rescue in those rare circumstances where people call us, say they're going to kill themselves and are not going to collaborate with us in any way. They're unwilling or unable to save themselves or to work with us to help keep them safe. Yet they call us, and we believe that based on what they're saying, if we don't do anything, they're going to die. And that is very important to note. He is being honest in that there may be circumstances in which somebody might go to the home, and we're going to talk about that more in sections 3 and 4. Question, does the Lifeline feature TTY services for the hearing impaired? And this is from the website. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline has TTY capability, which can be accessed by calling 1-800-799-4TTY. That's 4889. Please feel free to share this with people that are hearing impaired that may not be able to listen to the show and might need that information. Question. Is the Lifeline available in other languages for non-English speakers? Answer, yes. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline has a Spanish language line at 1-888-628-9454. We also provide the teleinterpreter service to our crisis centers, which support over 150 languages. So in other words, the national hotline has a Spanish line. The teleinterpreters is Teleinterpreters Incorporated, which is a California company, and businesses have them on standby to provide language services to their phone lines professionally. And so I assume when they identify a needed language, it's not English, they'll engage that company to help them out. Question, can the Lifeline and the Veterans Crisis Line also be reached by dialing 1-800-SUICIDE? This is an old number that they used to use. Yes, All calls from 1-800-SUICIDE have been routed through the Lifeline Network since March 2007. Callers to 1-800-SUICIDE are now being routed through the National Suicide Prevention's Lifeline Network of over 140 crisis centers across the nation. Question, what happens when I chat online with the Lifeline? So there's four basic steps. First, you'll see a wait time message while we connect you to a crisis counselor. Second, if demand is high, you can always look at our helpful resources below. And when they say this on the website, when you go to the website and you pull that up, there are all these links of different kinds of resources, depending, you know, whether you need first responders or you're looking for a counselor or you're looking for maybe a local hotline, you want to just go straight there instead of being routed there. Peer counseling groups, pastoral counseling, and all kinds of other stuff going on in there. They have all these links that you can look through. And so when you're chatting online and if you're waiting for a long time, you can also call the Lifeline because they're there 24/7. Third, a counselor will answer your chat, and this is when you're typing in the chat room. Fourth, the person will listen to you, understand how your problem is affecting you, provide support, and share resources that may be helpful. Your conversations are all free and confidential. Last question. What do I do if the online chat is busy or nobody answers? Answer. If the service appears offline or busy, please call the Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. They're available 24/7. If somebody you know or yourself is in danger or needs immediate medical attention, you are in full suicidal ideation and you are about ready to go, just please call 911. Get right to it. And then the last little bit of information, a crisis text line. Remember, we mentioned earlier that texting is becoming part of this culture. That is at a, there's information on that at a website called crisistextline.org/FAQ. FAQ. They also provide free 24/7 confidential support via text message to people in crisis, and they text 741-741 with the message they need to tell them. You can also contact them through the Facebook Messenger app. They actually have an identity in the Facebook Messenger app that you can message directly there. And at this point, I will pause and check in with Dr. Mathis and see if there's anything you'd like to add.
No, I'm good.
To put on some music for just a second, let's go back to Lita because I'm going to set up our caller who has an anecdote for us about having called one of these hotlines, and I want to make sure she's ready to go. I'll be right back.
Oh, cool.
Okay, guys, thank you for your patience, and we are back, and we have a caller from Atlanta, Georgia. We have Crystal on the line, and Crystal is here tonight to talk with us during Sections 3 and 4. Section 3 is on trust issues with suicide hotlines, and that's part of what we wanted to talk about tonight. Crystal has a story to share with us about having called a hotline and asked for help and ultimately had law enforcement come to her home, and things did not go very well, so Crystal, if you are ready, I would love to hear your anecdote so you could share with our listeners, please.
Thank you, Casey. Yes, I had called the suicide hotline number. I was, I am bipolar, and at the time I was very depressed, and I had a bottle of pills in my hand, and I tried that phone number, and it was kind of weird. They were really focused on getting my address, so I finally gave it to them. But then they asked if someone else is home that I could talk to. So that was good that they got me to go talk to my mom in a different room. And then my mom and I had already decided that we were going to go inpatient, but I wanted to take a shower first because, you know, inpatient showers are kind of gross. And mid-shower, my mom comes in and says, "You got to get out now." I still have, like, shampoo in my hair. I wrap a towel around myself and walk out, and this police officer is just, I mean, he was acting aggressively, like, not how you would think you would treat someone that, you know, that is depressed and thinking about harming themselves. I almost felt like a suspect to a crime.
So was he speaking very roughly with you or interrogating you, or what was he doing?
He was wanting me to get into his car and let him drive me to the ER, even though my mom was already prepared to drive me to the mental health place that I use.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I finally had to just say, "Look, no, I have my mom with me. She's going to make sure I'm safe until I get to where I need to go." But, I mean, it was scary. I was already depressed. I'm standing there in front of the stranger with just a towel on, soap still in my hair, because he wouldn't wait for me to get out of the shower. And, you know, I was thinking, God, I'm going to go to jail, or, you know, they're going to put me in the county mental health place, which this was back when I lived in Alabama, so you can just imagine, you know, how bad that is.
Yeah.
And
also, it's not the facility you're familiar with either, and they're not familiar with your case.
Exactly. It's also where they put the criminally insane, which kind of scares me. Yeah. So
they were saying they were going to put you in there with other people who have mental health issues, but some of them had performed acts of criminal whatever that was going on, and you guys are going to be in the same area?
Yes. Because the 24-hour watch includes everyone. And I had been to that place once before when there wasn't a room at my normal place. And there was a gentleman who decided to water the chairs, if you get my drift.
Oh, no.
All of them.
Oh, God.
I managed to get out of the way. So I did not want to go there again.
So how did that experience make you feel about calling these hotlines and reaching out for professional help or even volunteer help, like help outside your trusted friends and family? You know, how did this experience affect your willingness to go to them anymore?
I don't think I'll ever call a suicide hotline again. I'll call friends or family until I get someone, but, I mean, that was scary. And if you're suicidal, scary is the last thing you need. You need comfort,
absolutely.
And support.
I can understand that. Would you say the night that happened, even though you clearly were in crisis, would you say it was more of a cry for help than you really wanted to do harm? You really were just unable to cope? Was that closer to the truth?
That's a tough one.
Is that a tough question? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Please.
There are some people who definitely want to do it, and there are some people who just they don't know how to cope with what's going on, and they say it out of frustration and despair, but it isn't really what they want. They just can't think of what the hell to do. They're in so much pain that they just throw up their hands. And I guess I'm fishing for if you had a feeling for where you were with that.
I had a bottle full of Ambien that I had just refilled, and my goal was to empty that bottle. So I was in actual crisis at that point.
But you hadn't emptied it yet.
No, I had not taken anything yet. The suicide line, it was just like kind of a last-ditch effort because, you know, I didn't want my mom to know how bad I was at, you know. I was embarrassed, like, you know, not even good enough person to live, you know. It's when you get that depressed, it's really hard to reach out to people because you don't want to add to their problems, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But
I know
the
some
good
people
thing
have
about
said
the suicide hotline is they did get me to talk to my mother. And that was the good thing. I will give them that. They did get me to talk to my mother, who was in the house at the time. But that aggressively getting my address and then sending the cops, like, oh, my God, I was terrified. I mean, like, I was honestly wondering if he was even going to even let me get dressed and wash the shampoo out of my hair. It almost felt like I was, like, about to be arrested.
But he did eventually let you get cleaned up and go on your own power, correct?
Yeah. My mom used her second-grade teacher voice on him after he didn't get the drift the first couple times. And you've met my mom, so you know that voice.
Yes. Yes. I am very familiar with that voice. Okay.
So he finally left, and I went to the place that, you know, that I'm comfortable with and that I know has helped me in the past, and I got my problem taken care of, and I ended up better.
Good. Excellent. So I'm glad to hear that, and I'm going to pause here with your story, and then we're going to come back in a few minutes. I want to kind of talk about some other things, you know, coping stuff and strategies. And you had found an online website source that was more helpful to you. And I want to come back and ask you about that story in a few minutes. Is that good?
Definitely.
Okay. So thank you very much for that. And we'll be right back to that part. Let me go ahead and continue. Let's see. So we're talking about trust issues with suicide hotlines, and I have a few other areas that I want to talk about that are typical kinds of issues with this model. And some of them relate to the story that Crystal was just telling us, the first one being authorities interfering or the Baker Act. And I just named it that because a lot of people have heard of it. It's a law in Florida about, you know, people – if you go over a line and make a declaration of self-harm or suicide, they're legally obligated to put you locked up for, I think, 96 hours or something along that line. Several states have similar laws, but that's the one that people have heard of. So many people in crisis have lives that are so precarious that the intervention of professionals or law enforcement could destroy their living situation, their work, their child custody, or other situations. Even if it's justified, the losses could make a person even further despondent. So that's one problem, the trust issues with this situation. Second, balancing the need for an outlet with the public good or caller safety. So staff or even friends and family sometimes have to play a precarious sort of guessing game, trying to interpret comments made in the heat of despair to decide if professional intervention is warranted. They are almost never certain that they guessed correctly until more or less after the fact. The next thing I want to talk about is parroting. And this is a nickname for a technique called reflexive listening, but it's a common technique taught to crisis staff, but it comes off as hobbled and tedious to people in crisis. It is done by repeating back a description of what the listener believes the caller just said. Reflexive listening done in crisis makes the helper sound obtuse and uninvested, because you'll say things like, I'm really sad because my mother died and I kind of want to kill myself. And then you go, what I'm hearing is that you would like to kill yourself. And honestly, when you're really at that point, it truthfully sounds a little dorky. And I know that this technique has a lot of value in mental health treatment, but it's used a lot at these crisis centers. And this is a very rapid, high emotion situation, and that technique does not work for a lot of people. It's one of the chief complaints I read about when I was looking for flaws that people complained about with this model. That was a big one. Next one is texting, or preferred methods of communication. So texting has become really popular with 20 to 30 and even some 40 somethings because of the pragmatism of silent communication as able. Both traits a phone call lacks. Some with anxiety need the added barrier to engage others. There's some people that are very socially anxious, and the idea of having to call a stranger and tell them your problems is terrifying. And then when you add emotional crisis to that, it's a giant boiler pot waiting to go over. Many crisis hotlines have no text service. And although the current national hotline does, its upcoming successor does not contain plans for one as of yet. And let me kind of give you an example of why texting has become more popular. Suppose you're at the Christmas dinner and the family is really kind of being jackasses and you just want to curl up in a ball and die and you want to talk to somebody because you're so despondent, or maybe you're having dinner and somebody's missing and you're sad and you miss dad or, you know, whoever died and you need to talk. If you're typing quietly under the table to somebody, you can have that conversation when you need it instead of being on the phone where people can overhear you. Even if you go in another room and shut the door, people can hear your business. If you start crying, they can hear your business. But if you're typing, it's quiet and you can put the phone down for a minute and have some turkey or go to the bathroom or whatever you got to do. There's a lot less pressure to perform, and a lot of current adult culture is getting really big on texting for that reason. And so a lot of these hotlines are not taking that into account, so they're losing a lot of younger people. Another aspect is untrained staff when they're short-staffed or unprofessional responses. Some people manning the phones or chats don't have the training or experience that they should, and the responses may be useless or even callous. They put people in immediate crisis, on hold, send them to voicemail, or make them leave a name and number to call back. Sometimes this is due to poor or no local crisis resources to connect to. I get that. If you're not in a major city, sometimes they're fishing around looking for someone to send you to. Because remember, this is a national hotline. If you're in Nebraska or Florida or something, they got to try to find someone who can get to you. Text services can be no better. Some seekers have gotten perfunctory replies and told to go visit a website and help themselves. And worse yet, sometimes those website links are dead. Last complaint is wasting time. Poor responses of no value can exacerbate someone's crisis. Most suicidal episodes are temporary and can be de-escalated, but empty, disconnected answers can cause callers to think the staff don't actually care if they're helping. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you'd like to add anything.
Yeah, I would. One thing I want to say is reflective listening is a lot more than just parroting back. It's done with empathy. It's done with proper inflection in the voice, which kind of goes back to the point you made a minute ago about the untrained staff, because of the staff or lesser trained staff. So if you get staff that's not very savvy or haven't been trained really well, or, you know, just don't have the knack for this, because obviously you know, it's like you could put me in a situation with electronics and mechanics, and you could train me all day long, and I'd still be sitting there with this look on my face. And there's just some people who aren't cut out to do crisis intervention work. And unfortunately, if you have a, as you said, you're in a small community, you're in an understaffed situation, you get, you know, you take what you can get. And I think what happens sometimes is when you get those folks, well-intentioned people just don't have the skill sets, either because they don't have it or because they haven't been taught how to do it and haven't practiced it. So they come across as either uncaring or callous or uninterested or whatever. And that is definitely a problem.
Yeah, I do acknowledge that. Oh, I can hear me in the background. Go me. And reflexive listening is a useful technique when used correctly. And that is exactly the problem, that a lot of these places are run by volunteers. And they do have training sessions, but when the training sessions are not run by highly trained professional psychologist or somebody of that caliber fully explaining what it means, then you get the Reader's Digest training. And then it gets on the phone and you're in crisis and they say silly things because they don't mean to. But when you're short-staffed, you're like, oh, my God, get someone on the phone so we don't have to hang up. And unfortunately, this is what happens. And so I'm hoping with the advent of this national number that some of that will get better, hopefully.
Yeah, that would be great. So,
Is there anything else that you would like to talk about before we go on to
that? That was the only comment I wanted to make. And...
all righty. So the last thing that we want to talk about is resources and suggestions for coping. And this is where I'm going to bring Crystal back on. And Crystal, your microphone is now hot. She's asking in the chat room, is reflexive listening similar to mirroring? Mirroring is a sales technique, but she could see that being helpful. Yeah, there is a similarity to them. They're based on the same principle, where you basically repeat back what you think somebody heard and to establish that you're both referring to the same thing. And sometimes it will reveal that you're not, and then you can clean that up. So Crystal is now back with us live. And I'd like to talk about your Reddit story, about a success story online later on. So feel free, however you want to present that.
There are actually two subreddits that have really helped me through some hard times. I just, disclaimer, this isn't doctors running this. This is just people helping people. But the first one is called Suicide Watch, and I have posted there before, and in seconds you have people saying that you are loved, you are supported, tell us what we can do to help you feel better. In fact, the other one is called Free Compliments, and I just posted to them recently because I was having a pretty horrible day. If you don't mind, I'm going to put a link to that in the chat so y'all can see it and just see how people just give you free compliments. You don't even have to post your picture. You can just say, I've had a really bad day. Can somebody tell me something nice? The Suicide Watch one.
Or something.
Yeah, my cat did not want to put her leash on to go for a walk, but the suicide watch one.
I have a copy of the link, and I'll take a look at that later on to see some examples. But go ahead about the suicide watch on Reddit.
Not only do people respond to you, but you will have people sending you private messages saying, "Hey, I don't know you, but I've been there before. If you need someone to talk to, my number is blah." Or, you know, hey, if you just want to chat on via private message, you know, the outpouring of love in those two communities has been a big help to me. Now, I will admit, there's there are bad parts of Reddit, Lord knows.
But I was about to ask you if there was a troll problem.
those two subreddits in particular, which is Suicide Watch, all one word, and then let me make sure Free Compliments doesn't have an underscore. Free Compliments, also
written
all one
as
word.
Just one word, yeah, because it's in the link you sent.
Now, I recommend Free Compliments for when you're not all the way suicidal, but you're just really feeling down and you feel like that could go, like, you know, for me, for someone with bipolar, a small depression can very quickly, like, dip down into a major depressive episode. So if I go on there when I'm just slightly depressed, they cheer me up and I go on my way. But if I get to the point where I am feeling like I want to die, if I post on Suicide Watch, these are just regular people like you and me that just, you know, that share their love with humanity with people that need it at most.
Got it. Now, out of curiosity, how did you find those subreddits? So for those listeners, and I know Dr. Mathis, because computer things actually do confound him a lot, Reddit, reddit.com is a website, but there's also an app, and it's a chat forum, but there are thousands of little chat groups, little forums on hundreds of topics. And so you'd have to go and search, like, I want to talk about dogs, or I want to talk about bitching about work, or I want to talk about what it's like to live in Iowa, or you just have to think about it and search for it. So, Crystal, how did you find these subreddits and come to find out that they were actually really helpful?
Well, I actually started by looking for a bipolar subreddit because I didn't know anybody else that had bipolar. And, you know, it's one thing to have your doctor telling you something, but it's another thing to have somebody else that knows what you're feeling to tell you, hey, this is how it's going to feel. You know what I mean? And usually in there's a sidebar on the computer version. It's kind of weird looking on the app. But the sidebar has useful links, and I saw one of them was Suicide Watch. Free Compliments, I kind of just stumbled upon by accident. I started with Free Compliments, giving compliments to, like, everybody I could. I just went down the list. Everybody's getting a compliment. And then, you know what? When I was the one that needed compliments, I got them.
Yeah.
I like the people helping people aspect of Reddit.
I'm glad to hear that's going on, because sometimes those websites can attract trolls and people who, you know, do stuff just to be shitty. They want to just see if they can push your buttons and see if it'll work. And they don't stop and think, you know, this person may really not actually be able to cope with what you're saying. You could be pushing them into something really horrible that's going to end up in the news tomorrow. And so I'm thrilled to pieces that you found places where that's not going on, because there's a lot of the internet that is infected with that nonsense. So that's wonderful.
One good thing about Reddit is the moderation teams differ from subreddit to subreddit. The Suicide Watch subreddit, if anybody even says anything remotely trolly, that post is deleted. That poster's not allowed to, you know, banned for a while.
Okay. So they heavily police stuff on the Suicide Watch Reddit.
Yes. They don't treat it as, you know, something casual.
This is helpful to know that somebody's looking out for it, because that can make an awful lot of difference if you don't have somebody looking out, especially when you're upset. You don't have time to figure out who you need to block or ban or whatever. You're just like, I just need somebody to help me get through this hell. and that's all you can manage. So,
yeah, I can tell you, I know firsthand because I've seen it happen. I saw like lifetime somebody post something about being in a hero, and it was like 30 seconds later it was deleted and that person was gone. So they're super quick to find trolls and to get the trolls off.
Got it.
No, that ain't true for all of Reddit.
So by way of explanation for our listeners, I want to jump in here real quick. The N hero thing that she was just mentioning is a very old internet meme, which basically is a way of trolling somebody into self-harm. And usually it's meant as a joke. And once in a while, there are people who want to be edge lords and cross that boundary just because nobody will. And so obviously the moderators of the forum don't allow that behavior, which is very heartening. And that's something that's very important about these sources. You need monitoring by people who are going to protect those kinds of boundaries, especially when you're in crisis, you don't have the ability to protect your own boundaries, you know, the way a person not in crisis probably can handle. So it's very important that somebody's got your back that way.
Another good thing, I just thought about, there are several subreddits where you can just say, hey, I'm alone and I need a friend. And it just matches people up with the same interests so that maybe somebody that might be feeling suicidal because they're lonely also has that option of maybe meeting somebody.
Wow.
Some random stranger that, you know, has the same interest in them as them. And, you know, you and I were internet buddies for how long before we knew each other in public, in person? You know, friends.
Almost 10 years.
Yeah, internet friends are big these days. Like, it's not like the old days where, you know, well, my mom was terrified that everybody I ever met online was going to, like, murder me. But, you know, these days, internet friends are important.
Yeah. It's also a little different because you're just typing. Like, I could be up at 3 in the morning and be really sad and I could type something. Now, unless you're having a true emergency, you wouldn't call a friend at 3 in the morning just to say something. But you could type it out and then maybe the friend gets up to go to the bathroom and they see it. And then they can come back and talk to you. But you haven't disrupted anything or caused a big crisis, but you're still getting help and interaction and validation because it's at your own pace. And you can't do that when you see people in person. It doesn't work the same way.
Well, I do know Suicide Watch and Free Compliments. I apologize about my voice. I'm fighting the flu here. I have a very active Australian crowd. So if it is 3 a.m. our time, it's
someone's
not
up.
3 a.m. their time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good
so,
point.
Yep,
that's the other beauty in the internet. Not everyone's on your time zone. So sometimes when you have a need at weird hours, there's somebody up. That's good. Good to remind people of. All right. Is there anything else about your experiences with this stuff that you think might help people or that you'd like to share?
My main suggestion would be if one thing doesn't work, don't stop at the first thing. Give it 2 or 3 tries. Your life is worth more than just one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Keep trying. Keep fighting.
Yeah.
You are special to someone. And people do love you. So whether
that is
it be
so true.
Online or Reddit or on the National Suicide Hotline, but maybe don't tell them your address if you don't want the cops to show up.
Well, you know, that's valid. Maybe, you know, people should be able to get help without having to worry about that. And that's one of the pieces of feedback we're trying to get to them, is that I know you have to act when people say certain things, but on the other hand, when you guess wrong, this happens. You know, it's a hard thing to guess, but your situation is very unfortunate. When they came over to the house. Alrighty, so I'm going to go ahead and close this part of it. You're free to lurk and hang out with us, and let me know some stuff in the chat room if you have some more things you want to add. And I'm going to continue to the last part, suggestions of coping mechanisms for people. So I want to thank you for sharing your story, and hopefully there'll be listeners out there that maybe will be able to get some advice from that and some help. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and turn
you
back on
me.
You're most welcome. All right, so let's go ahead and finish talking about the last part, resources and suggestions for coping. So we have a couple suggestions for improving the hotline that were not mentioned that they're going to do, or specifically mentioned they're not doing in the article. Just some quick ones. Local crisis resources in all 50 states at the minimum, and at least in metropolitan areas. We do realize that some people who are away from a metropolitan area really don't have a realistic expectation of a high volume of resources, because they're just not there. But if the hotline is going to be national and be a one-size-fits-all for people, maybe some states or some regions have to cultivate a point of contact for these things. I don't know. Volunteer groups can get involved. You know, various civic groups, mental health groups. I'm not sure who. And, you know, maybe we can talk about that some more on another show. But definitely they need some more resources. They only have 140 across the country. And that's only a couple per state. We have 50 states. So it's like two or three per state. Another thing they need to deal with is re-adding the texting or SMS feature. As we mentioned, this is becoming more and more popular. It's very pragmatic. You could be sitting there and putting on the Christmas face at your dinner or your company party and trying to pretend everything's fine, and it's not fine, but it's very easy to text somebody and talk about it. But it's really hard to pick up that phone and go outside on the back porch and have somebody overhear your business. So the texting's got to come back. And also TTY service. I did not hear that that was going to be in the new service, and that's very important as well. I'm going to check in with you real quick, Dr. Mathis, before we have the second part of the discussion about resources and suggestions for coping.
No, I'm good right now. Thanks.
Okay. So I do have one comment that I want to make. We have suggestions for coping methods for the depressed and suicidal. I have an article I want to read you guys. But before that, I have something that I want to say, and then Dr. Mathis has something he wants to add. And that is, I know when you guys call, you need a place to vent. You need a place to be truthful and get some help. But you need to take responsibility to understand as best as you can that if you directly say anything about harming or killing yourself, that you outright say it, you run the chance of somebody calling 911 or a similar first responder intervention, and some responders are required to take action under special circumstances. Once in a while, these things are a matter of state law, like I mentioned the Baker Act earlier. We do realize that when despondent, you may not be thinking clearly, but right now while you're listening and you're thinking, you need to understand that such comments are never to be made lightly, and they run the risk of inviting professional intervention. So if you're going to be really worried, justified or not, that a professional shows up at your home or your place of work or something, I had another friend of mine who suggested this topic to begin with, had somebody call the police to show up at her work, and she almost lost her job. And she was not suicidal. She was just deeply depressed, and she was upset. but she was not about to take her life, and it almost cost her her job because somebody overreacted. So watch your mouth, what you say to people, because they have little checklists, and sometimes they're required to act on it. So you have to be careful with your language. And then at this point, I know Dr. Mathis wanted to make a related separate point about attention calls.
Yeah, make sure that if you call a 911/suicide hotline, that you really are suicidal, that you're not doing it as a ploy to get attention, you're not doing it because you're lonely and you just wanted somebody on the other end of the line, or you wanted to get a reaction, or you're doing it to get back at a boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, lover, parent, sibling, whatever. If you're going to call, don't ever use the threat of suicide as a manipulation or passive-aggressive F you statement or an anger, I'll show you statement. Be genuine about it, because a lot of these places really are overworked, and they need, for lack of a better term, people who are really serious about it. They need to have the lines freed up for folks who really, really need help and services. And so if you do need help and services, absolutely call. If you're upset, talk with a friend. Don't call and, you know, falsely get crazy on a suicide line, because, as Casey mentioned, some of these places are required to take action, and then you're going to be all upset they took action when you really weren't suicidal to begin with. So please reserve these calls for genuine stuff, but do call if you are genuinely suicidal, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. None of this is to be used as a weapon. There are thousands of people who are serious, and the resources for this are super, super thin in this country. And so please don't take that up because you want to make your boyfriend feel bad because he broke up with you. Please don't do that, ever. The next story that I want to read to you guys, article, is by Ilya Dastagir that I mentioned from USA Today again. And this one is entitled, If You've Ever Had Suicidal Thoughts, Make a Safety Plan. This is a very good one. And hopefully this is something you will hear on the show now while you have clear mind. This is written November 2018, so a little over a year ago. And she's suggesting a format for developing a suicide safety plan. Even if you're not suicidal, if you're just significantly depressed to the point where you're worried about your safety, it's okay to go ahead and maybe form one of these, just so that you have that safety net, literally, just in case it gets worse. So see, these are her suggestions. Sit down with someone you trust. It's ideal to create your safety plan with a mental health professional, but if you're not under the care of a clinician, you can turn to a trusted friend or family member. The reason why it helps to have a clinician or another person is sometimes if you're in a distressed place, you're thinking about these things isn't always 100%. You know, sometimes your roommate or your mom doesn't know how to help you with that. Second, identify your personal warning signs. The warning signs listed on your safety plan, and like, be clear, this is a document that you're going to write up for yourself and print out copies, and you may give them to a couple of key people. We're going to talk about that in a minute. The warning signs listed on your safety plan should be specific to you. These are the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors that may lead to you feeling suicidal. According to the Suicide Prevention Resources Center, they can include talking about feeling trapped or in unbearable pain, and that can be emotional pain, physical pain, any of those. Talking about being a burden on people. Increasing your use of alcohol or drugs, and it could be prescription drugs, but maybe you're taking more than you should be. Acting anxious or agitated, behaving recklessly, especially putting yourself in dangerous situations for no reason, especially if you weren't a danger seeker before. Sleeping too little or too much. That can be a sign of depression or a clinical problem, but just keep an eye on it if it's in conjunction with any of these other guys on here. Withdrawing or feeling isolated. Showing rage or talking about seeking revenge. And extreme mood swings. These are not one size fits all. Some of these might not affect you at all. Feel free to amend this list as it's relevant to you. You are the one who knows when you are really in danger and when you're just kind of having a bad day. You got to write it down. This will be very helpful for stopping those false calls. Like if you tell somebody, I fly off at the mouth and I say this shit and don't pay any attention to me, if you wrote that down and you gave that copy of that to your trusted people, it will be something that they can show responders so they don't come traipsing into your house and make you lose your job or whatever else. Okay, another thing you can do, find ways to distract yourself. Since thoughts of suicide typically come and go, it's important to find ways to distract yourself when they emerge. This could include, but is not limited to, exercising, listen to music, read a book, watch a movie, meditate, calling a friend. Making your environment safe. This is a good one. It's important that if you have thoughts of suicide, you reduce access to lethal means. Ask a family member to safely store medications or have a friend hold the key to your firearm box if you have something like that in your house. Or this applies to anything else. If you might go and use something when you're despondent, give control of that thing to somebody else for a while. Turn to people you trust. Who do you call when you want to laugh? Who do you call when you want to vent? Who do you call when you want someone to come over and just sit with you? Write their names and contact information down on your plan so you can easily reach them when you need to. My personal note, inform them of this and make sure they consent to the role. And we actually talk about that a little further down, but I didn't feel it was as clear as it should be. Make more than one copy. You shouldn't be the only one with access to your safety plan. Give copies to everyone you list on your plan so they can be proactive. And again, make sure they consent to this, because your whole thing could get screwed up if your best friend wasn't told about this sort of thing, and then there's a giant crisis and the cops are knocking on your best friend's door to see if you're okay. And they're like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Why am I involved in this? You got to make sure they know. Don't surprise people with stuff like that. Include the professionals. Your friends and family are important supports, but you should include emergency contacts on your plan who can help you if your feelings escalate. This can include your therapist, primary care physician, local mobile crisis hotline, 911, or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Keep updating the list. Super important. As things in your life change, your safety plan should too. If you lost touch with one of the people on your call list, make sure to add another trusted support in its place. If you found a new reason to stay alive, include it. Write it down. And also, you know, if any of these things disappear, take them off the list. Remember, you're not alone. When you're in crisis, it can feel like there's nowhere to turn. A safety plan can be a life-saving reminder that there are people you can reach out to for support. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, before we go to the next part.
I'm good, thanks.
Okay. Suggestions for friends, family, employers, or neighbors of the depressed or suicidal. This relates to the topic, the caveat that I just gave you guys a little while ago. Don't call in authorities unless you are absolutely beyond any doubt that they are about to harm themselves and have said so directly and clearly. Being confronted, if not in immediate crisis, could be triggery for someone and escalate things even worse. So here's the other article by Aaliyah Dastagir. This is from September 2018. Suicide prevention experts, what you say and don't say, could save a person's life. So she says, for every person who dies by suicide, 280 people think seriously about it but don't act, according to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. There's not one answer to what makes someone move from thinking about suicide to planning or attempting it. But experts say feeling connected to other people can help. So she has some tips. Tip one, if something seems different, don't ignore it. The most important thing you can do is look for a change in someone's behavior that suggests they are struggling, says April Foreman, a licensed psychologist who serves on the American Association of Suicidology's Board of Directors. Foreman notes changes in behavior are some of the most telling indicators, but it's important to look for specific warning signs. For example, talking about wanting to die or to kill themselves, looking for a way to kill themselves, like searching online about it or buying a gun when you didn't have one before. talking about feeling hopeless or having no reason to live, talking about feeling trapped or in unbearable pain, talking about being a burden to others, increasing the use of alcohol or drugs, acting anxious or agitated, behaving recklessly, sleeping too little or too much, withdrawing or isolating themselves, and yes, most of these were listed earlier, showing rage or talking about seeking revenge or extreme mood swings. Tip number two, don't be afraid to ask, then act. The most important thing you can do if you think someone may be suicidal is to ask. It may be hard, but it works. The National Action Alliance for Suicide Prevention and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline have identified these five steps to help reduce deaths. Number one, ask. In a private setting, ask the person you're worried about directly if they're thinking about suicide. Studies have shown that it does not plant the idea in someone who is not already suicidal, but rather reduces the risk. Number two, keep them safe. Determine the extent of the person's suicidal thoughts. What could I do to help you stay around until this passes? And then listen to them and help them do it. Number three, be there. If someone tells you they're thinking about suicide, continue to support them. Ask them to coffee. Give them a call or a text or whatever. Number four, help them connect. Encourage them to seek additional support. This could mean calling the Suicide Lifeline. Again, going to hammer this in, 1-800-273-8255, TALK. Suggesting they see a mental health professional or helping them connect with a support group. And number five, follow up. Keep checking in. Call them or text them. Ask them if there's anything more that you can do to help. Tip number three, pay special attention when someone is going through a difficult time. You can check on people based on what you know about them. Says John Draper, director of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You know when a person's having relationship problems or going through a divorce. You know when somebody has serious financial loss. These are very human, recognizable signs that people could be needing help. Tip number four, if someone makes an attempt and survives, continue to be there. A lot of people do not. One of the risk factors for suicide is a prior attempt. Studies show that suicide survivors often experience discrimination and shame and may struggle to talk about their feelings because they're worried people will judge or avoid them. If someone you know is a suicide survivor, the Suicide Lifeline says, check in with them often. Tell them it's okay for them to talk about their suicide feelings, and you mean it, walk the walk. Listen without judgment. Tell them you want them in your life. If they start to show the warning signs, ask them directly if they're thinking about suicide again. Call the Lifeline for advice on how to help. This is an example of, you know, the Lifeline is there. You may not be suicidal, but you may need advice on dealing with someone who is. They're also there for that. And tip number five, you don't need to have all the answers. It's important to encourage someone who is having suicidal thoughts to call the Lifeline, find a support group, or reach out to a therapist, particularly one who specializes in evidence-based suicide prevention techniques, such as dialectical behavior therapy and cognitive behavior therapy for suicide prevention. And at this point, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if you have anything further to add.
Yeah, I just want to say two things, basically. First of all, someone who attempts suicide is 10 times more likely to try it a second time than someone who's never done it. So it's really important to support folks who have attempted suicide and failed, so to speak, which is a good thing to fail at in my book. The second thing I would say is use whatever works. There's all kinds of, you know, cutesy techniques and all kinds of different approaches and different coping mechanisms. Find something that works for you and do it. And there's no one size fits all, as you mentioned earlier, and there's no one answer for everybody. Everybody's different. Everybody has different weaknesses and strengths. Just, you know yourself and have whatever it takes to survive, and it's going to be different for everybody.
Yes, very, very true. I wanted to add a couple of quick things. We had suggestions from Crystal in the chat room. There is an app called Youper, Y-O-U-P-E-R, which is an app that's kind of like an AI therapist. It checks up on you every day, and if you have a certain number of bad days when you interact with it, it will suggest that perhaps you want to go see a professional and that kind of stuff. It's not a substitute, but there are some people who have no insurance, have no time, whatever. And so it's good for that, you know, because if you have a phone, you can have a therapist. She also suggested adult coloring books. They do give some people a kind of meditative state. It's not for everybody, but some people really like that. And it's not a suggestion that comes up that often. So, you know, put both of those out there as other ways that people can get help. So if that is everything, I want to make sure that in summary, our listeners now have a more helpful understanding of the structure of suicide hotlines and what they do and do not offer people in crisis. So essentially, this concludes our show on the National Suicide Hotline. And I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to add.
No, I'm good. No, thanks for your, you know, for your insights, and thanks for Crystal calling. That was cool.
Awesome. Yes, thank you. Actually, I'm going to give her applause for sharing her story and helping people out. It takes a lot of courage to put that out there. So hopefully that'll help somebody out. On behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and our caller, and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, January 8th, 11 p.m. ET, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. At this time, the only one I know of is still The Walking Dead Online Viewing Party, on hiatus in conjunction with the TV show Returning Season 10, Episode 9, Sunday, February 23rd, 2020. Please come back and join us then. As for The Rock and Roll Shrink, please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on.